Topic number two. This month of June 1982 has seen the apparent end of one war and the beginning of another. The war between Britain and Argentina for the Falkland Islands ended, at least for now, on June 14. That day, the Argentine garrison at Port Stanley surrendered to the British. Meanwhile, a new war was already underway in the Middle East. Israel had launched its long-planned all-out invasion of Lebanon. The Falkland Islands War had come as a surprise to the master planners of nuclear war to come, the Bolsheviks here. The Falklands fighting and the secret hostilities which preceded it were intended to upset those nuclear war plans, as I detailed in Audio Letter 74. And so the Bolsheviks, who were fomenting violence worldwide, stamped out the unwanted Falklands War as fast as they could. The Thatcher government in Britain, which is Bolshevik-controlled, is now left with a legacy of grievous losses which are being covered up. A major key to the Thatcher cover-up of the true extent of British losses is the continued posture of belligerence toward Argentina. It is being said that a sizable British military presence will be maintained in the South Atlantic. This provides a tailor-made excuse for the fact that many British ships, sailors, and soldiers will not be coming home anytime soon. The fact that some of them will never return home can be hidden, and the families affected informed piecemeal, a few at a time. In this way, the Thatcher government intends to keep the lid on the situation. Another ingredient in the Thatcher cover-up plan is the at-sea repair ship Stena Inspector. It was bought from American interests in May and is now being refitted at the Savannah Shipyard Company in Georgia. Soon it will head for the South Atlantic to begin patching up many British vessels which were damaged in the Falklands War. When and if they return to Britain, the true extent of the damage done to the Royal Navy will have been literally covered up. The final outcome of the Falklands War was a setback for the Rockefeller cartel and their limited partners, the new rulers of Russia. The Rockefeller-Soviet team won round one of the South Atlantic fray, which was a covert warfare during April. I gave the details in Audio Letter 74. But round two, the battle for the Falklands themselves, turned out differently. Despite the damage done to the Royal Navy, it was the Rockefeller cartel and the Russians who were outmaneuvered in the Falklands battle. It was known that the objective of the joint Rockefeller-Russian action in the Southern Hemisphere was to upset Bolshevik nuclear war plans. So the Bolsheviks responded by deliberately overreacting militarily. Virtually the entire Royal Navy was dispatched to the South Atlantic. A situation was created in which a British recapture of the Falklands could not be stopped without setting off nuclear war itself. Finally, a totally unorthodox landing tactic was used to get British troops ashore, as I detailed last month. The end result was that the Rockefeller-Russian pledge to the Argentine junta was impossible to fulfill, at least for now. The Bolsheviks are hoping that the resulting turmoil now taking place in the Argentine government will halt Argentina's rapid move toward Russia. In the past, Argentina was always staunchly anti-Soviet, but under Russia's new rulers, a major and growing trade relationship has been building between Russia and Argentina. The majority of Argentina's huge exports of meat and grain now go to Russia. And last month, relations between Argentina and Cuba suddenly started warming up. The Bolsheviks here would like to reverse all this and ultimately deny Argentina's food to Russia. Whether that will happen remains to be seen. If nuclear war one does not erupt first, there are likely to be many surprises down the road in Argentina and Latin America. But as I say these words, the final war sequence planned by the Bolsheviks is already getting underway. This is the sequence of brushfire wars and regional crises which are intended to lead directly into nuclear war one. This intended final sequence of crises began this month on June 5. On that day, Israeli tanks began moving across the border into a so-called Christian enclave in southern Lebanon. The following day, the world learned that Israel was launching an all-out invasion of Lebanon. More than a year ago, in AUDIO LETTER 63, I made public the joint strategy of the Bolsheviks and Zionists to pave the way for nuclear war. It was a complex five-track plan patterned after the build-up to World War I with its proliferation of pre-war crises. I now quote from AUDIO LETTER 63, "All five tracks in the Bolshevik war path converge about mid-1982. By then, they expect to have America on a war footing. All four space shuttle missions are planned to be completed by then. The offensive weapons now in the works will be ready. And by then, the world will be a cauldron of crises, made to order for setting off nuclear war suddenly and without warning. Just as crises in the Balkans triggered World War I, a world in crisis will trigger nuclear war I." End quote from AUDIO LETTER 63. Mid-1982 has now arrived, my friends, and the Bolshevik maneuvering to drag the world into war is right on schedule. This month, on June 13, the Washington Post published a major article titled, "A World Suddenly Assaulted by Gunfire." It begins, quote, "By State Department count, three major and eight lesser wars were going on last week in a world that seems suddenly beset by blazing battles," unquote. Yes, my friends, it is sudden, but it is not accidental. The Bolsheviks here are responsible for the fires that are burning worldwide. Their plans, laid out more than a year ago, are now reaching fruition. As I've detailed in the past, the Bolsheviks, now headquartered here in America, are allied closely with the militant Zionists in Israel. This situation is as much a mystery to the people of Israel as it is to the people of America. In both countries, the average citizen is getting worried. In Israel, as in America, the present government is bent on deliberately raising the level of tension, violence, and nuclear war danger. In both countries, more and more people are becoming alarmed over the growing danger without realizing that it is all deliberate. The government which now rules Israel came to power in a sudden, astonishing change in April 1977. The previous Prime Minister, Rabin, resigned abruptly. As always in these situations, a suitable excuse was found for public consumption. In Rabin's case, a mini-scandal over insignificant financial matters was fabricated to explain away his departure. But the real reason was what I reported that month in AUDIO LETTER 23. Rabin had learned of secret plans for a major Middle East war and wanted no part of it. Rabin was replaced by a man of very different attitudes. The new Prime Minister was a man who frightened many that had been thought incapable of seizing control of the Israeli government. He was known as an extremist, tracing all the way back to his days as the most wanted of all Israeli terrorists by the British. The idea that he might actually rule Israel someday had been unthinkable to many. Suddenly, the new ruler of Israel was a man named Menachem Begin. Begin is representative of the most extreme faction of the political movement known as Zionism. The Zionists use religious-sounding terminology and biblical words to disguise the true nature of their goals, which are satanic. Political Zionism is as different from classical Judaism as night is from day. Like all the world's great religions, classical Judaism is based on worship of the Almighty, and it does so from its own distinct perspective. Judaism emphasizes the justice of God, Islam, His righteousness and power, Christianity, His love, Hinduism, His spiritual essence, Buddhism, the peace that comes only from God. Justice is the hallmark of true Judaism, but it has nothing at all to do with political Zionism except as a deceptive slogan. The Jews who have been lured to the land called Israel have gone there, by and large, believing the promises of a better life. But what they have gotten instead is a government which per capita has become the most violent and warlike on earth. "There is no peace, saith the Lord, for the wicked." And the Begin government in Israel is as wicked as the Reagan government here. Modern Israel is no longer a threatened underdog. as it constantly pretends. Instead, Israel has become the world's third most powerful nation militarily, after Russia and the United States. Using its runaway military might, the Zionist government of Israel is setting the world on fire. It is doing so with the blessing and support of their American Bolshevik allies. The agony which is being inflicted on tiny Lebanon, which has never done Israel harm, is beyond description, my friends. Over 10,000 Lebanese civilians have been slaughtered by the Israelis, and over 600,000 made homeless. Even the sanitized reports on American television cannot entirely hide the wanton savagery of the Israeli invasion. One report after another shows devastation of entire city blocks on a scale not seen since World War II. On all sides, the reports describe Israeli shelling and dive bombing of Beirut, Sidon, and other Lebanese cities with one word, indiscriminate. My friends, classical Judaism regards man as a crown and glory of God's creation. Man is supposed to have been formed in God's own image. Would God, the just God of Judaism, have done what Israel has done in Lebanon? Are arrogance, bestiality, and genocide in the image of God? Or are they in the image of Satan instead? What the Israelis are doing now in Lebanon is claimed to be in retaliation for provocations by the Palestine Liberation Organization. But the fact is that the present events are part of the long-range plan to bring on nuclear war. In Audio Letter 70 last December 1981, I reported that, quote, "The joint war plan of the American Bolsheviks and the Zionists in Israel is still on track. They are shooting for a Middle East war to break out before the end of summer 1982. End quote. It is now the summer of 1982, and the desired Middle East war is raging. In Audio Letter 68, I reported the Begin plan was to goad the PLO into violence. Time after time over the past year or so, the Israeli Air Force has mounted devastating air raids on Lebanon, creating widespread devastation and death. The purpose of these repeated Israeli violations of the ceasefire was to provoke a highly visible counterattack by the PLO. With that as a pretext, the Begin government intended to justify its planned invasion of Lebanon. But the PLO never did respond in kind to the Israeli goading. Aside from occasional small raids and shelling incidents, nothing was done that was sufficiently dramatic for the intended purpose. Meanwhile, time was running out. The fast new war timetable required the Middle East war to get underway without further delay. So on June 3, the Begin government provided its own pretext for war. That day, the Israeli ambassador to Great Britain was gunned down by an assassin hired by Israel's own intelligence agency, the Mossad. The Begin government immediately professed to be outraged, saying this was the last straw. 2 days later, the Israeli forces, which had already been massed along the Lebanese border, invaded. The unbridled savagery of the Israeli attack has shocked the world. In effect, the nation that calls itself Israel has turned the Palestinians into the new Jews of the world. They have no home. They are dispersed. They, along with the innocent victims of their host country, Lebanon, are the victims of genocide, a military holocaust without justice or mercy. Protests and condemnation of the Israeli behavior in Lebanon are mounting worldwide. Nowhere is the worry greater than within the Jewish community itself. In Israel, popular sentiment against the Begin government is erupted into widespread demonstrations. And elsewhere around the world, many Jews are also speaking out against the Israeli-inflicted holocaust. But through it all, my friends, the Reagan-Begin axis of the American Bolsheviks and the militant Israeli Zionists continues to function smoothly. In his United Nations speech of June 17, the entity President Reagan condemned armed aggression, quote-unquote, and to the new Russian pledge not to be the first to use nuclear weapons in war, Reagan demanded, quote, deeds, not words. But when it comes to Israel, those criteria are never applied. The Begin government agrees in words to one ceasefire after another, but in deeds it breaks each truce when ready. And Israeli armed aggression has left nearly 20% of the population of Lebanon homeless. The whole world is shocked and outraged, yet all this has not provoked even a slap on the wrist for Israel from Washington. My friends, the satanic Begin government is now in its sixth year in Israel. This month, June, is the sixth month of the year. On the fifth day of the month, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon began, and with it, abominations of military desolation. It all brings to mind the visions of the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 8. The prophet says in the first verse that he was shown visions in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of that month. He was shown abominations spawned in the Holy Land by people who arrogantly said, "The Lord does not see us." The chapter ends in the words, "Then he said to me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence, and have returned to provoke me to anger, and lo, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eyes shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them." Topic number 3. Earlier this month, on June 18, there was a fascinating announcement from NASA. Two American spacecraft, the most distant man-made objects in the universe, may be on the verge of a major new discovery. These two space probes have been racing through space for 10 years and 9 years, respectively. After all that time, they are now nearing the edge of our solar system, whose vastness is almost beyond comprehension. And as they do so, they're preparing to observe a giant mystery object in the skies. The mystery object, whatever it is thought to lie billions of miles beyond the outermost known planet, Pluto. It is so far away that it has never been observed by astronomers here on Earth. Yet many are sure that there is something out there. Something, whatever it is, keeps disturbing the crisscrossing orbits of little Pluto and giant Neptune. The effect even penetrates inward to the monster planet Uranus. So no one knows what it is or where it is. It may be a tenth planet. It may be a dark star farther away. It could even be that most chilling of all celestial objects, a black hole, with gravity so strong light itself cannot escape. No one has seen it, so no one knows. But now, after a decade of space travel, two American deep space probes may be on the verge of giving us the answers. The probes are Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, launched in 1972 and 73 respectively. They are nuclear-powered spacecraft designed to escape from our solar system and coast forever through the void of interstellar space. When they cross the outer boundary of our solar system around 1990, they are expected to be sending back data about what they find. It should be mankind's first taste of interstellar space. That is, if anyone is still listening by then. 2 months ago, on April 12, 1982, Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine devoted its editorial space to a statement by Dr. James A. Van Allen. Dr. Van Allen is the space scientist who discovered the radiation belts around the Earth that now bear his name, 24 years ago. His article is titled, "Pioneer's Unfunded Reach for the Stars." He listed an astonishing list of major new discoveries made by the Pioneer probes during the past decade, and he issued an appeal for the program to be saved from imminent destruction. Dr. Van Allen's article begins with the sad words, quote, "One of the most incredible features of the fiscal 1983 program of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is a premature termination of the deep space missions of Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. The annual saving is $3 million, or 4/10,000 of the agency's budget," unquote. My friends, the so-called Reagan administration decision to cancel the half-completed Pioneer program is incredible. but it's in character with this administration's entire approach to space and science in general. Anything that will help the Bolsheviks here prepare to wage war is funded, no matter how much it costs. But everything that merely adds to the peaceful, constructive knowledge of mankind is being guillotined, no matter how little it costs. For the past year and a half, I've been reporting periodically about this developing situation. America's space program has been systematically whittled away to leave almost nothing but the space shuttle. The space shuttle has been spared only because of its critical importance for military purposes. Over the past year or so, military control of the shuttle program has become more and more blatant. The Bolshevik war planners who now control the United States military will brook no interference with their nuclear war plans. The overt military takeover of the shuttle program began just over a year ago in May 1981, following the Hindenburg disaster of the first shuttle flight. The civilian director of the shuttle program, John Yardley, was eased out. Several months later, in October 1981, he was officially replaced by an Air Force general, James Abramson. Since that time, the Bolshevik warlords have been expanding and consolidating their control over the shuttle and NASA itself. Reorganization has become the order of the day at NASA, with military control becoming more absolute with each change. In its original concept, the space shuttle was to be a stepping stone into space for both civilian and military purposes. It was to be a system that would continue to grow and be improved over the years by continued development. But that idea has now gone out the window, thanks to the total takeover of the shuttle program by Bolshevik military managers. To them, even the shuttle is only a short-term stepping stone to war. They intend to set off nuclear war one before any further development of the shuttle could bear fruit. And so, under Bolshevik military control, NASA is now turning its back on the traditional mission of advancing the technology of spaceflight. The entire NASA emphasis is shifting towards using the space shuttle as is for the short time left before war. The most stunning result of this radical policy change within NASA was announced about 2 months ago in April. It involves a man whose name is practically a synonym for America's manned space program. This man has played key roles in the planning and engineering of every single American manned space program. He was a member of the original Project Mercury team. He was deeply involved in the follow-on Project Gemini and a central figure in the Project Apollo Moon program. He directed the design and implementation of the Mission Control Center in Houston. And for the past 10 years, he has been director of the Johnson Space Center. If you have followed America's manned space program closely over the years, you probably know his name as well as I do. I am talking about Dr. Christopher Kraft. The Bolshevik warlords here have decreed that NASA's days of technological development are now at an end. So one day last April, Dr. Christopher Kraft was told that his services are no longer needed. And he was fired. As I say these words, my friends, Space Shuttle Mission Number 4 is underway. This is the last of the four initial crash military missions to prepare for Nuclear War One. Each of these first four missions has involved two shuttles, not just one, as I first reported in audio letters 62 and 63. Each time, the shuttle we see blasting off from Florida follows a path into space that is different from the one publicly claimed. As a result, it cannot return to Earth at the time and place it is supposed to. Therefore, the two-man crew of each flight returns to Earth in a small Gemini-like space capsule. Then they board a different shuttle and rocket into view from a distance to land at the advertised time and place. I've given all the details in the past, so I'll not repeat them now. In the first three space shuttle launches, the launch took place into the northeast. Each time, this was the beginning of a long, curving launch into the north to a near-polar orbit to pass over Russia. But this time, the shuttle took off in a different direction. It took off due east from Cape Canaveral into something called a minimum inclination orbit. This time, it was heading not for the North Pole, but toward the equator. The reason for this has to do with the secret Pentagon payload. It is a special sensor system designed to give confirmation of the first phase of the planned American nuclear first strike on Russia. As I reported last month, quote, in order to do its job, the Air Force infrared sensor has to be placed in geostationary orbit. That orbit is over 22,000 miles high over the equator, unquote. In television coverage of the launch 3 days ago, the new flight path was mentioned briefly but not explained. For example, the transatlantic abort site this time was Dakar, Senegal, close to the equator. This is a change from the first three flights, in which the transatlantic abort site was Rota, Spain, much farther north. The shuttle itself cannot go high enough to put the Air Force sensor into its final orbit. Instead, the sensor is perched atop a rocket carried in the cargo bay. For engineering reasons, the rocket had to be loaded into the shuttle while it was standing vertically, not parked horizontally. That's why, for the first time, the shuttle was loaded for this flight after it was ready on the launch pad. NASA spokesman admitted publicly that this was done, but as always, they never tell you the reason. Last month, I reported that an on-schedule launch of Space Shuttle 4 would indicate that the Pentagon nuclear war plans are still on schedule. Sunday morning, June 27, Space Shuttle 4 became the first shuttle ever to take off exactly on schedule. Not a moment's delay was permitted, even though a sudden violent hailstorm the previous day had ruined more than 400 critical heat tiles. So far, this shuttle flight is apparently proceeding as planned. That means, my friends, that the September deadline for Nuclear War One is still in effect as of now. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've been forced to be the bearer of bad news. The anti-nuclear war coup d'etat planned by General Alexander Haig has collapsed. More surprises are possible, but the time is now very short. The intended final war sequence has now begun in the Middle East at the hands of Israel. And Space Shuttle Mission No. 4, the last one needed for nuclear war, is now in progress. My friends, the danger of nuclear war is now the greatest that it has ever been since the summer of 1976. I cannot tell you for sure whether war will or will not erupt by September, because these war plans are the plans of men, and they are not infallible. What I can tell you for certain is that these days ahead will be filled with danger. The Rockefeller cartel has apparently failed in its game plan to stop the Bolsheviks here. That leaves the arena of conflict to the Bolsheviks here versus the rulers of Russia. Two more deadly enemies are impossible to imagine, my friends. The Bolsheviks here are racing to position themselves for an all-out attack against Russia. Preemptive actions by the Kremlin to prevent that attack are virtually guaranteed. The results may well shake the world. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.